My name is David Cicero. I'm an education consultant, a math teacher, an explorer of pedagogy, and a dad. Join us as we leave a lasting impact on education, one conversation at a time, here on the Edmentum Podcast. Welcome. Last year, I caught wind of an AP history teacher out of Austin, Texas, who decided to pack her bags and take her students on a virtual road trip through America's history. I wasn't the only one who noticed. Her online videos and Twitter updates gained popularity quickly. Perhaps you read about her in an NPR article or one of the thousands who watched one of her YouTube videos. Her name is Catherine Cluck, and she is the one responsible for the hashtag Great American History Road Trip. I've got Kathy on the line today. Kathy, for those listeners who may have seen this in passing or don't know anything about it, can you just give us a rundown on what the Great American History Road Trip is all about?
It was an idea that came out right at the beginning, really, of the school year, at the end of July. I had an idea that if we were going to be starting the school year remotely, what if I could teach history from the places where history actually happened? I've been a U.S. history teacher for 27 years now, 28 years. And the idea of trying to reframe the fears that I had going into this school year, if I could reframe it into something that I would never have been able to do in a normal year, that's kind of what got me thinking about what is something I could do that I would never be able to do if we were starting in person. And so about 3 weeks before the school year started, I had this idea and I texted my principal and I said, is this even a possibility? And he said, the only thing you got to care about is technology, but yeah, make it work. And so I took off. Our kids came back to school on a Wednesday and I took off the following Friday and drove from Austin to the East Coast. I wanted to end up in Williamsburg, Virginia, starting with colonial history. That's where we start our class in AP US history. And I just hit a bunch of historical sites, you know, on the way. And it was an opportunity as much for me to dive into history, as much for me to do something different, but also it was a way for me to try to have my kids get to know me in a way that they probably would never have been able to if we were in a normal classroom setting. So that was it. It was literally just a road trip. And I went to historical sites and I made videos and I held Zoom classes from various places. And I would spin the laptop around and say, look, there's the Washington Monument. And we just kind of went from there. It was a big collaborative effort with my students and myself and my principal and a couple of people on campus who were back here in Austin helping me out. But it was just a fun, weird, crazy idea that I had that actually worked.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like fun. Now, there's a couple things I want to ask questions about in what you said. So how did you choose locations? Was this places you were interested in? Did you think, hey, these places, was it tied to the curriculum at all to help engage students in topics, let's say, that historically, that, you know, they may not be very interested in? And it could be any of those answers. So how did you end up choosing what your path was going to be?
Well, I initially started with, I wanted to go chronologically with the course. So my goal was to get to colonial Virginia by the following Monday. And I wanted to do lessons from Jamestown, from Williamsburg, because that's what we were going to be studying at the time. AP US history covers the entire scope of US history. So I knew there were places that I would be going to that were out of context with where they were studying. I was only gone for about 2.5 weeks. And so, you know, when I look at sort of the calendar of the year, the scope of the year, that really was only going to cover colonial history and American Revolution. But I knew there were places that I wanted to go to, Gettysburg, the Lincoln Memorial, Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, that will come up later on in the class. So a lot of it was, I knew I wanted to start with colonial Williamsburg. So that was the starting point. And then trying to get to as many spots within a 2-week window that I knew we would come back to throughout the year. So knowing that I had to be back on campus by the day after Labor Day, that sort of narrowed what I could do and where I was going to be able to go. So within that, I thought, okay, if I know I want to start Colonial, I know I also knew I wanted to go to the Washington Memorial. I mean, the Lincoln Memorial. I have a friend at school who said, you have to promise me that you will sit on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and do a lesson. And I was like, that's just the coolest thing. So I did. And then within that, it was other places along the way that I knew I could do videos and we can use them throughout the year. So Gettysburg, Weehawken, New Jersey, where the Burr-Hamilton duel was. I also knew I wanted to stop at the Civil Rights Museum and the Lorraine Motel, but we won't be covering Civil Rights and the Lorraine Motel until spring break of this year. So that one we'll come back to. But it was time constraints. It was what all can I get to within 2 weeks while I'm driving and have a chance to sleep. That was kind of what determined it.
Yeah. Actually, the Lorraine Hotel that you mentioned, that lesson that'll be used later, it makes me think of like, hey, you've got a repository now, you know?
Right, right.
And I mean, even if someone couldn't take time off, or not take time off, but if they were limited in the time they could take to go visit sites, they could, I could make a video and have it as a part of my repository and use it later in the curriculum, right? Exactly. I don't know if you planned on that, but that's kind of what's happening now. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And of course, you have these videos now forever for next year and the next year, right?
Right.
And so that's pretty awesome too.
And it's something I want to build on. It's something, there were sites that I had to leave out. I had planned initially on going into Boston for the American Revolution stuff. And when I got into New Jersey, I realized I just sort of had a flashback to the spring where New York was so hard hit by the pandemic and Boston had a travel advisory and I'm from Texas and they didn't want Texans coming in. And so I changed my plans halfway through, but I didn't go to Boston. I didn't go to this original sites that I wanted to go to because of the pandemic and because of time. But I also now have a framework for how I can do that in the future, where I kind of know how to do it now. I can go to any of these places and make a video and keep that, like you said, in the repository.
Yeah. So you say you want to keep building on it. So I'm curious as to when that thought occurred, like after you realized, hey, I can do this, or you're having this idea now, hey, I can build this out. Why do you want to keep building this out?
Well, selfishly, it was really fun.
Right.
It was very fun for me. I'm such a history nerd. And to be able to go to these places was, I think I'd been myself to all of the places where I did videos from. But I wanted to share that with my students. I wanted to share that with kids. And it was a way for me to sort of satisfy this dorky need to share history, but it's also a way to bring history back to a position of this is still real life. This is still current. It still matters. It's still important. And, the Burr-Hamilton duel site, that was the one place I had not been that I sort of said, I'm going there. I'm going to make this work. I was only there for a brief window, maybe a day, only a couple of hours actually at the dueling site itself because of the pandemic. Because I didn't go into the city at all, but there was just this sense that Hamilton has had such a big impact on American society and high school kids love it. And so if I can show them this really is where it happened, it kind of brings it all together full circle, that this is not, history is not something that is distant. It's not something that we study a whole bunch of names and they don't really matter anymore. It's still very relevant, whether it's pop culture like Hamilton or whether it's the Lincoln Memorial the day before they were having a big Black Lives Matter rally. And I was showing my kids how they were setting up and they were doing sound checks. And it was on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. I was there the day before the anniversary of that. And to be able to come back to that when we get to Martin Luther King this spring and to be able to show them that that the ideas that he was talking about back in 1963, they are still so important and still so relevant, and history is unfinished. It's not, those chapters aren't closed yet, and we have the option to bring them back into relevance and to really assign importance back to some things that maybe have kind of been relegated to the back shelf a little bit.
Yeah. I don't think that what you just said, I don't think that that is possible just sitting in a classroom.
Right.
There's so much I want to say. So let's go back to the Lorraine Motel.
Okay.
Now, that's not a lesson you'll use for a little bit, but I watched that one. I watched a few others. I tried to watch them all. And so I'm watching this video of you standing there, mm-hmm. and you really set the stage. I don't know what you did on purpose and what you did not do on purpose or whatever, but it seemed like you just experienced the location. Mm-hmm. You pulled in an old photo mm-hmm. Of King's advisors, I think, or his, mm-hmm. his affiliates pointing to where he had just been shot.
Where the shot
and then you show that you're actually there where they're pointing. Mm-hmm. The music that you chose was a sort of somber music. Obviously, it makes sense that you chose somber music, but that added another element for me watching the video. And then also your reaction, your tone changed. Your tone is different in Jamestown than it is there at the Lorraine Motel,
right?
And so I really got to experience that. And I learned from that video too, by the way. I learned a few things I didn't know. That it's almost like you helped me, like you created a model for experiencing that piece of history. Mm-hmm. How should I be reacting to this? How is she reacting to this? You know, and so what you just mentioned of, hey, I was taking video of the setup for the it wasn't a protest, was it, you mentioned?
No, it was a Black Lives Matter rally on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's 1963 speech.
Right. And so experiencing history today and sort of conflicting emotions in a way too, right? You watch the Lorraine Motel video, you feel a certain way, and now you bring it full circle back to today. And you know, I may feel empowered now that we're able to, you know, able to rally, right?
Right.
Really
right.
Understanding it in a very holistic way. You know, oftentimes, you know, I like to read a bit of poetry, and also I kind of analyze, you know, songs and things like songs written by Paul Simon and Elton John. And I read people's interpretations of those songs. And sometimes I think, did Elton John really mean what this person is interpreting? You know, I think he just wrote it, you know?
Right.
And so I wonder how, you know, sort of how much was conscious of, you know, you're filming the rally. You're also filming the other side of the historical idea. Is that on purpose, or is this you? Are you yourself also just sort of following this passion of fully experiencing the moment
It was not really planned out. I didn't have a script for what I said. I really was just in the moment. I was really impacted by the George Floyd moments this past summer. I am a white woman of privilege, and I fully acknowledge that I have privilege and I have opportunities that other people, people of color, people who have not been as lucky to receive the education that I have. I fully acknowledge that is a privilege. And when I watched the protest this summer, there was in Austin, there was a protest on Saturday after the George Floyd murder, that really was, I just sat in my living room watching the TV and crying and thinking, how can I do anything? What can I do? That Saturday, I remember it felt like it was a protest by largely people of color in Austin. And I was just watching it hurting along with them, that there are these centuries of pain, of subjugation that does not go away with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 or the you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that doesn't fix it. That you can't just have one piece of legislation fix hundreds of years of abuse and denigration. And the following day on Sunday, I was watching the protests, and the protests in Austin at least seemed to have transferred from just a protest by Black people, but it was white people, old people, young people, Hispanic people, Asian people. It turned into a humanitarian moment. And that, to me, I think having witnessed that in the summer and seeing how much pain is still going on and how much work we still have to do just for racial awareness. Racial relations is another level, but just awareness. And then being able to go to the Lorraine Motel and see that spot, and so much of what, and it was also very shortly. I think Congressman Lewis had died maybe a month before I went on my trip. And so seeing Congressman Lewis, to me, was such a hero, because he was in that picture. He was in that picture after King was shot. And then to see him standing on the Black Lives Matter plaza in Washington, D.C., a month before he passed away from cancer, and knowing that one lifetime, that one man had been able to transcend so much and be so important, just one guy, so important to an entire multiple generations of people. To me, it was important just to sort of stand in that spot and recognize what that means.
And that, what you just said is really the key, I think from my perspective, to what this effort is. Because I think that's a question. What is this? You know, what is this? Is this just connecting kids, connecting to your students through social media? Is it just making videos to supplement your lessons? I don't think that that's what this is. I think really that we're watching Kathy Kluck experience history, but also experience what's happening today as a historian would.
Right.
Like the practice of history, right? As we practice this field, mm-hmm. you don't just watch something on the news and take the, you know, current interpretation and just take it at face value. You turn around and you look at the history. You say, you know, where did these places happen? Or where did these things happen? Where are these places? What's the history? What's happening current? How do we compare the two? And so as I think about your videos and watch your video, that's what I think I'm watching. I'm watching essentially, you know, a historian saying, I'm going to approach this, you know, in sort of the right context. And we're learning how to do history. I mean, wouldn't it be fantastic if a student came to you and said, I was watching the Black Lives Matter rally, and it just got me thinking about this historical thing and right. where we came and all of these. That's how we want them to think.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
And it's also so important, I think, as a historian, I love looking at the individuals. And that was one thing that sort of in the back of my mind, it kept coming up throughout this trip, was that this history, these big events that we study, that we are forced to memorize, whether it's names or dates or whatever, they're made up of individuals. And the individual, I mean, I think that's why Congressman Lewis's story is so inspiring to me, that this one individual, this one guy, had such an impact on not just other individuals, but movements and legislation and governments and societal reactions. And that to me is what's inspiring, that each of us can take this moment. And when we look at these various points of history, their history is being done by these individuals who made certain choices, and we have that opportunity as well. And so I think that's why it was so important for me to be at the Lorraine Motel. I didn't go into the Civil Rights Museum. I didn't really go in to any enclosed spaces because of the pandemic, but being at that site in that moment and knowing how far we still have to go, but how far we've come, And all of that work is done by people like you and I. And we all have the ability to shape our little world around us and make those choices. And collectively, that makes society better. Like, we're not trying to change all of society, but we can change the people that we interact with, and we can make those choices that then will have that sort of wave effect, that ripple effect.
Absolutely. And that's an ongoing thing.
Right.
Right. You're constantly sort of reevaluating your environment and your circumstances, and then constantly deciding what the best course of action is to take. Right. And I'm trying to also link this to another subject area, because I just read an article, or halfway read an article. You know how we sort of read articles today.
Exactly.
I skimmed through it. I read most of it, but it was about a math teacher. Mm-hmm. I forget where, and it was a few months ago, who basically decided, you know, we're going to learn the math of epidemics, uh-huh. right? Because of COVID. Now, this isn't unheard of, right? In classrooms forever, we have been pulling in current events, right? But I think I sort of see through this fog this opportunity to sort of be active in the subject area and as current as possible at the same time. So in your case, you know, we're coming up on learning about civil rights, and so we start to find things to connect this to today. I wonder how frequently we would be able to do that, because if I were, as a mathematician or historian trying to say, let's look at something that's happening today, and now let's turn around and view this, right? And so everything we're learning, or nearly everything, or as much as possible, is connected to something that's happening now.
Well, and that's what makes education work. That's what makes learning successful. When kids are told you have to memorize this list of battles and dates and names, it means nothing. But when you can tie something to their everyday life, that's when kids know, okay, this is important. It is important that I understand history, because I need to be able to vote as if I understand what the premise is. What am I voting for? Who am I voting for? What do they stand for? I think studying pandemics from a mathematician point of view is going to make math relevant. And kids need to understand, you know, kids today are not just going to say, okay, I blindly accept what you're telling me that I need, that's important. They need to know. You know, my kids question me all the time. They're like, why do we really need this? Is this really important? And I'm with them. If I can't give them a justification other than it's going to be on a test, that doesn't seem like that's enough to me. So
yeah, it's not. And I think it's sort of pointing to a more agile teaching process, right?
Right.
We want to include real world scenarios. Well, how current is that real world scenario? I think is the case. My conjecture is we want it to be as current as possible. We're choosing a real world scenario to analyze or to see this problem through. How current is that? Would it happen yesterday? Did it happen last month? Right. And so this more, and next year, that same lesson, the same way you did it, may not work this year, because we want to tie it to a current event again.
Exactly.
Right. So it's just much more fluid. The word agile, the word sort of the phrase active teaching, I'm not sure if that exactly makes sense, is kind of entering my brain now. And that's maybe we understand that would be great, but I feel like that's not necessarily happening everywhere. This sort of idea of active teaching, constantly looking at the subject matter that you're trying to teach and then looking out into the world and saying, what can I connect this to today? Now, if it wasn't a current event, I'm thinking of Jamestown. You were in Jamestown. I pulled this thing out, but still pulling it towards something that's sort of tangible now. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to help me. You were at a site, and you started talking about how thankful you were to have, a stove, right? It was a burned down house, was it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I thought, wow, me too. I'm thankful for these things too.
Right.
And again, back to that idea of you're showing me how I should be looking at this. You're showing me how to reflect about this. You're giving me this model. Yeah.
I think that it at that spot, it was it kind of these tumble down foundations of homes of the original Jamestown village. And, you know, I'm walking through these stones essentially that are the kind of the walls of what this house was. And I'm thinking there were, you know, probably 8 people living in this place that's smaller than my bedroom. And they're cooking their food and they have, you know, they don't have any of the conveniences that I live with, that I, you know, put gas in my car and I can drive across the country in 2 days and, you know, stay in hotels and have air conditioning. And, you know, I had the moment when I was in Jamestown, it was in August, the end of August. And by that afternoon, I kind of set up camp essentially at the Jamestown site all day. And by that afternoon, I was just getting bitten by mosquitoes over and over again. And I had the thought, I told my kids, I said, y'all, this is what they died of. The original settlers, they died of malaria. What if I die of malaria in the age of COVID? But because I got it at Jamestown, I mean, it was just sort of that, again, it goes back to those individuals, that these were people. These were individuals who were slapping mosquitoes just like I was. But I live in a time when a mosquito bite is not going to kill me, most likely. And
that's what's great about it, actually. Yeah. That's what's great about it. Look, they used to roll in the cart with the TV into my classrooms too when I was in school, right? And anything that's technology is engaging, you know, different levels of engagement depending on the technology, right?
Right.
And could you show some type of documentary on Jamestown? Absolutely. You could mm-hmm. find one, right? And
it'd be very and, professionally done.
Absolutely. And that's okay, right? Mm-hmm. You pull in technology, you're pulling in a video, and you've got your lesson plan, you know, based around part of your lesson plan based around some of that. That's awesome, right? The reason I think that this approach works and is sort of the direction that we need to be thinking about is that it is personal. It's Mrs. Cluck. It's Miss Cluck. You know, it's not whatever the narrator's name is. We don't know that guy. And also, was this documentary made yesterday? Is he going to say things and react to things and interpret things the way I would today? Mm-hmm. Right? So the now is so popular now, right? Everything now, video now, you know, how is she reacting to it? The way you reacted to the mosquitoes is mm-hmm. probably, right? You know, you're not going to die from it, but you still made a joke about it, right? The way you talked about it is the same way someone now would talk about it, you know?
Right.
And so I can connect in that way. And so this idea of just, you know, it might be super idealistic, but if we're reaching for an idea that is probably really just outside of our grasp, mm-hmm. it's how can we present the now in everything that we do? How can we make it as current as possible all the time, right? Tough. But I think that's what is making this so shiny and so meaningful, you know?
And I think also sharing ourselves with our students, that helps them relate that they live in a world. And, you know, I grew up during the Cold War. I grew up with technology always being a little bit scary. And kids today grow up with whether they're, it's people they follow on TikTok or people they, you know, follow on other social media sites. They want to know about that person's life. They want to know about sort of the mundane. And to some degree, it's a lot. It's like, why do you care that much about some person that you've never met? But what I think happens, and one of the reasons why I think that these videos that I did were successful was because it was part history, but it was also part just me sort of sharing the experience. And we like to live vicariously with other people's experiences. And I think, again, when I sort of reflect back on it, probably what was most beneficial, for my students was the fact that they got to know who I am, that I'm going to be their teacher for 9 months, 10 months, however long the school year is. But I don't have them in class. So we're missing that weird little window of time before class where, you know, I'm talking about new shoes that I got, or, you know, how I spilled coffee on my shirt. And I mean, that sort of humanizing element, that we're not getting that. And I think what they got out of it was a chance to know me and a chance to sort of build that relationship when we don't have the normal opportunity to build those relationships. And to me, relationships are the most important part of teaching. If kids feel like they have a relationship with you, then they're going to do whatever you want them to do. They'll come through on the homework and the studying and the whatever. But it has to be grounded in a lot of that kind of relationship world. And so I feel like in looking back, it gave them a window into who I was. And what we've done since then is it's almost like, okay, y'all saw me in my moments of slapping mosquitoes, or my moments when I got lost, or my moments when the technology didn't work and I thought it was a horrible mistake that I did this. So now they're going to let me see them. And I think that again, with kids in high school, at least they get really invested into not just what the person is saying, but who the person is. And I think those moments of humanity, again, allowed me to connect with them in a way that they would then buy into what I wanted them to learn.
Just being authentic, just being yourself. This is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. And take that risk. Take that risk of making yourself vulnerable and sharing. You know, a lot of times we feel like as teachers that we're supposed to have these polished lessons and they're supposed to be on and engaging from bell to bell. And life doesn't work like that. And one thing that I've learned during the pandemic is that it doesn't work like that. And we're just sort of rolling with it. So I think that ability to just say, this didn't work, this did work, let's try this. I feel like we've got a lot more freedom to do that these days.
Yeah, when we talked before, when we were sort of prepping and getting to know each other a little bit, we talked. I know I was throwing words out because I didn't know quite what the theme of our conversation would be, and I threw out these words: experimentation, fail fast,
yes,
making little bets,
yeah,
you know, just in case you lose, right?
Right.
And also that idea of sort of active teaching, and so I think you're hitting on something, and it's actually something that I'm thinking about. You know, the beginning of this year for educators and as I help schools and consult is, you know, does the culture of schooling really allow for these little bets and experimentations? Kathy, what do you think? I mean, I'm just.
Well, that is, I could not have been able to do this little adventure that I did without the support of my principal. Our administration, I am lucky to work in a really supportive school. My principal at 9:30 on a Friday night texted me back and said, yeah, I think it'll work. Just figure out the technology. He was supportive all along and was encouraging me. I mean, there's not a lot of bosses who would say, you're about to start a new job. Sure, go take off and drive around the country for 3 weeks and just, you know, log in, do your job, but, you know, whatever. The ability that my ability to do this trip comes directly from the support that I have. And I work in a school where my principal, our assistant principals, my ed tech, who at 9 o'clock on a Monday night, he was Zooming with me, teaching me how to do a video. When I was in Williamsburg, he's teaching me how to make a video and how to log on to YouTube. I could not have done it without specifically my ed tech and my principal. They are the ones who really made this successful. And having that support, having that foundation allows teachers to go off and do these sort of adventures. And I think that education, if we have administrations who support it, teachers have all the freedom in the world. And teachers can do it. We've seen, you know, we saw in March when we went home for spring break and it was like, oh, you're not coming back now. Figure out how to do teaching online. And teachers did it, you know, all across the country, all across the world. Teachers pivoted immediately from you're in my class, you're sitting in your rows, you're doing your group work to, okay, now we have to figure out how you're still going to learn things online. And kids learned, you know, in that crazy period after spring break, between spring break and May, I would log on with my classes and I'd be like, what do y'all want to talk about today? And we'd talk about Watergate. We'd talk about, you know, the Vietnam War. We'd talk about the Cold War and the end of the Cold War. And my kids told me at the end of last year, they said those were the best lessons that were so engaging. And they would just ask questions. I was just sort of telling stories. But again, I had the freedom to do that. And we had an administration team on our campus that was saying, we're not looking for how you taught in the years past. We're looking for how you teach now. And they allowed us to experiment. They allowed us that freedom and they kind of took down the parameters. And having that support base meant that we were free to go and explore these options and these ideas. I think that if we want teachers to be creative, you've got to have administration that will allow that. And a lot of times administrators don't. They're not comfortable with not micromanaging.
Now, taking what you said and taking what I know about the work you've done and also just the way I think, mm-hmm. I know you said a moment ago, you know, if you have schools that are like this, you will, you know, foster innovation. And I'm wondering if we need administrations like this. We need to be doing things that are going to start opening up these boxes. I think yes.
Absolutely.
I'm curious as to what you or do you think we don't really have a choice? what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think we have a choice. I think absolutely we have to have administrations that foster it. I think that when we look at this is going a little bit off in the weeds, but when we think about the education system as it exists now in America, it is an education system that was designed to produce good factory workers. The education that we have now, where kids have to show up on time and they move from one spot to another with a bell, and they are to sit and accept instruction. They are to produce a product, and they're not really supposed to question a lot. I think we've moved a little bit out of that. We do encourage a lot more questioning. But there are a lot of teachers and a lot of administrators who don't want students to challenge them. They don't want students to say, but wait, what if we do da 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 da? Because it's uncomfortable. But the system that we are educating our kids in now is a system that's 150-ish years old, 170 years old. And it was to produce factory workers. We don't want to produce factory workers anymore. We want to produce thinkers. We want to produce innovators. We want to produce creatives. We want to produce problem solvers. And I think that if that's our end goal, we have to change how we're educating kids. And a shift in that is allowing teachers to change how they are teaching kids and doing stuff like I did. You know, it's a different way. It's a different concept. It happened because of a global pandemic. But, you know, I think there's a lot of positives that can come out of this global pandemic, that it has forced teachers and administrators to really shift what it is that they value and what is the outcome that they want. You know, just in when we look at testing, when we look at standardized testing or testing in schools, we've had to shift how that's going to work. The standardized tests that kids used to have to get into college have been adapted and changed. And maybe kids don't need the SAT as much as they needed the SAT. Maybe it's more about projects they produce, and that determines how they should get into college. I think that we're at this tipping point where we have the opportunity to really change education for the future, as opposed to basing education how it has always been in the past. And I think we need to take that opportunity, but taking those opportunities means that we have to have administration teams who will support that.
On that, I think that's all sums it up. And so Kathy, I really appreciate you coming on today. I really, really appreciate and am inspired by the work you've done. I'm going to still hunt down some things I haven't watched yet. We'll be subscribing to your YouTube channel to see what's coming up next. So thanks, Kathy.
Thanks so much, David.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Edmentum Podcast. If you like what you hear, you can support our show by subscribing and leaving a review. If you're looking for more Edmentum resources, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn under the handle @Edmentum. Stay tuned for more episodes, and until then, stay well.